and welcome. My name is Anna Partridge and I'm excited to have Dr. Christy Goodwin with me today, who is a child's technology and brain researcher plus a mum. Welcome, Christy. Thanks for joining us. Being a child's technology and brain expert sounds really interesting. Can you tell us a bit more about what you do?
Sure. I am fascinated, some might say obsessed, about how technology is changing the way young children learn and develop, play. Basically, I'm looking at how technologized childhoods are impacting on children. So I draw on a range of research. I look at the technology research. I look at developmental, psychological research. And I translate that research into what parents and educators really need to know. How is technology use helping and perhaps sometimes hindering the way our little ones learn, develop and play?
Oh, which is a huge topic of interest. You know, obviously coming from your background and from my background as a school teacher, you know that it just has such a massive impact on our kids. And so you're here to tell us today, you're going to debunk five of the most common myths and misconceptions when it comes to young children and technology, which is exciting.
It is, and I often say to parents, because I know firsthand as a parent myself, just how much confusion there is and a lot of guilt around this topic. I say there's a lot of myths, misnomers and misconceptions about kids and technology, and it's often presented as a very much a black and white or a philosophical argument. It's something that we can really polarise people. And whether we love technology or loathe it, it's here to stay. So our job, I think, for parents and educators is to leverage it. How do we use it in the best ways possible that are going to support, not perhaps stifle, the way our little ones learn and develop?
I think one of the biggest fears is that it's going to change the brain patterning of how we operate.
Absolutely. And do you know what? I will tackle this right here and now. Because whilst we may not have a comprehensive neuroscientific picture yet, I mean, we only have to think the iPad's only 5 years old, so we don't have any long-term neuroscientific data, but what we do know at this point in time is that every single experience that your child has literally shapes their brain and rewires it. So I think there's very little doubt that technology is rewiring children's brains. It's just the extent to which it is and whether that is either a positive or a negative thing.
Yeah, good. All right. Well, let's get started with the myths that I've got here in front of me. So the first myth is that TV is bad for children.
Yes, a really common myth. And when I often debunk this, I hear usually a collective sigh from parents when I'm speaking to them. Look, I use technology, TV, every now and then with my eldest son. And it's really, really helpful. And I don't feel guilty about it. I often talk about techno guilt, and that's something a lot of parents are riddled with. And TV can actually be really helpful and beneficial for kids if parents meet three criteria. So for TV to be beneficial, it needs to be, often it's labelled as educational. I say there's three criteria. First, it needs to be very repetitive. So I don't know if you're familiar with Dora, but often in Dora episodes, Dora will repeat the sorts of tasks that she's going to do over and over again. And that's because we know that educational television needs to be repetitive. It also needs to be very linear. So television shows need to be very predictable and follow that same sort of format. And the third criteria is that it needs to be very slow-paced. We know that what we call rapid fire, the really fast-paced action cartoons that children often really like, are not really beneficial for them. Slow-paced is definitely what developing brains need. So if you can find those three criteria in television programs, your child can actually benefit. We've got overwhelming evidence that tells us that when children use television programs that are classified as educational and are legitimately educational, that they can benefit in a whole host of ways. We've got ample evidence, for example, showing us that Sesame Street is really beneficial for young children. So obviously what they're watching is really important, but we also know that if parents watch, not necessarily with, in an ideal world, certainly we'd be sitting on the couch watching TV with our children, but I'm a practical mum and I run all the research through that practical mum filter, and I know that's not always feasible. So what I say is that if you can't sit down with your child and watch a TV program, just asking them about what they're watching, it stops what I call the digital zombie effect, where they literally tune out. And it guides them and scaffolds them to hook what they're seeing on the TV to their real life experiences or to prior experiences they've had as well. So TV can be beneficial. It's not all doom and gloom. Obviously, what they're watching is important, but equally so is how they're watching it. Are they watching it with you or with other siblings to interact with as well? So it's not all bad.
And I've also heard that the research that shows that when you turn the television off after a certain period of time, their minds are still, if they're watching the rapid fire, as you call it, when they come away from it, it takes their mind some time to calm down. Is that true?
It is. Again, it's a matter of what they're watching.
Yeah.
But that's why in the parent seminars I run, I often say this is part of the seminar I know a lot of parents don't really like hearing, but I often say, two times of the day where we should really minimise children's exposure to that rapid-fire, fast-paced screen use, whether it's a television program or more often these days it's video games that are that rapid-fire pace as well, is before school and 90 minutes before children go to bed. What we know is that it does stimulate. Those sorts of fast-paced programs really do stimulate their brains and makes it a lot harder for them to either go into a classroom or to school or to preschool and concentrate. And or at night time, we also know that screen use can really have an adverse impact on their sleep.
Okay. Oh, that's all brilliant.
So it's true, unfortunately. But again, it's what they're watching and also when they're watching it as well.
And so, you know, for age groups, I see that for like, you know, 2 to 5 where they're watching Dora or Peppa Pig or something like that. But when they're a little bit older and they're 6, 7, 8, 9, 10... and they're watching, I don't know what, but are there any shows you can recommend in that age group?
That is a lot harder age group to find programs. I often recommend at that age range, children usually have a broader sort of outside interest. So if you can find, you know, if they're interested in animals, the David Attenborough style television programs, more of the factual kinds of programs can work really well with that age range, particularly if they've got an interest in, you know, whether it be horses or something more topical. And given the advent of, you know, streaming television through the internet now, we can often really tailor what our kids are watching online too, to find something that's of interest and relevance to them. But that is definitely a really difficult age range to often find good quality programs for kids.
Right.
Seem to go from, you know, the really child preschooler type academic type programs to preteen sort of material that's not always age appropriate for those in between
age ranges. Like, I think one they were watching the other day, Skip vs. Cat or something. Oh, that anyway, got it off pretty quickly. Well, that's brilliant for TV. Okay, let's go on to our next myth. The second myth is there are safe screen time limits.
Excuse me. Sorry. This is a really, really common myth, and it's not often helped by what we're told. The Australian federal government actually have some screen time limits. The Department of Health and Ageing, the Federal Department of Health and Ageing, released these screen time guidelines back in 2011, and not many people know about them. We have very similar guidelines in the US. The American Academy of Pediatrics have screen time guidelines. Both of these documents are fairly similar. Basically, the screen time guidelines suggest no screen time for 1 to 2 year olds, for 2 to 5 year olds, 1 hour a day, and for five years and above, 1 to 2 hours of total screen time a day. So this includes all screens, television, DVD player, iPad, interactive whiteboards at school, laptops. So these limits are actually came out in Australia. They came out of an anti-obesity policy, and this anti-obesity policy classed all screen time as passive and non-productive. And I think that there is certainly evidence to show that if television, or sorry, screens are used excessively, they can have an adverse impact on children. But my concern with these screen time guidelines is that it's classing all screens as equal. And what a child does with an iPad can be very, very different to what a child's doing if they're just watching passive TV. So one of my big concerns is that this research isn't grounded in the more interactive types of technology that we now have and that children are using. And my other concern is it's just not realistic. In this digital age, I've seen overwhelming studies that are showing what actual media usage is across this age range, and most families are greatly exceeding these screen time guidelines. And my big concern is that it can almost set up a false economy, that if we sort of can lull parents into a safe zone. So if we say, okay, they're only having 1 hour a day, but 1 hour a day watching age inappropriate material may not be beneficial, and I think we can also get lulled into that false sense of, well, they're under their threshold, so it's okay. There really is no magical quantifiable amount that is necessarily safe. Having said that, I don't suggest that we give children free rein. I certainly think they need screen time limits and that we need to be mindful of how much screen time they're having, but I just don't think there's a prescriptive measure or a one-size-fits-all measure for families. A study came out earlier this year that found that nearly 80% of Australian families are exceeding the recommended screen time limits as well.
And when you put the boundaries and guidelines around it that you've just talked about, of age-appropriate screen time and, including interactive whiteboards that they have at school, then you can actually see, can't you, that the screen limits don't work.
Absolutely. And it can place parents in a really tricky situation. All of a sudden you do feel guilty thinking, oh my goodness, I've exceeded that safe threshold or the recommended threshold. So my thing is that we need to revise those guidelines to meet the sorts of digital world that our children are inheriting. I don't know whether we can actually prescribe. I definitely think kids need limits. And I think sort of a rough recommendation is required, sort of an outline or a suggested amount, but I don't think that prescriptive limit I to some extent I do support the no screen time, not necessarily no screen time, limited screen time for under two. So I think that's a really vital period for brain development. And I don't think that we need to be in a hurry. I often say to parents, there's no hurry to dunk your child into the digital stream. Like, there is plenty of time for that to happen. Those first 2,000 days, in fact, in a child's life are absolutely vital for optimal brain development. So,
I think we used to watch The Wiggles under two.
Yeah, and fine. I've also got a 19-month-old, and he's not interested in watching TV. He's too busy. But every now and then, he loves nothing more than swiping through my phone, looking at videos of himself or his brother. And that's a really, that's the other thing too. Like, again, if I was strictly following the no screen time, he'd be missing out on those rich sorts of experiences. You know, the other day we went down to the park, down to the lake, and he was feeding the ducks and I took a little video of it. And then that afternoon when my husband came home from work, he loved sitting there showing my husband the video and was trying to say duckies and water and all this sort of language that if he hadn't had that screen, there's no way he would have been able to try and communicate with his dad in that way. So it's really what you're doing. And I think in those early years in particular, in fact, with all the years, if the parent or a carer or even an older sibling is nearby or in proximity, you can really be supporting and advancing their learning at the same time as well. So I definitely think we need screen times, but I just don't think there are hard and fast safe thresholds too. I think we can get lulled into a false sense of security and or guilt.
Brilliant. Okay, that's that myth busted then. Let's go to our next myth. Video games are harmful for kids. And if you can touch on Minecraft here, that would be great.
Oh, I could. I know lots of parents are literally bamboozled with their children's obsession with video games and Minecraft as well. I often hear people saying Minecraft is a minefield. Like, they really just don't understand kids' obsession with a digital Lego world. But it really is enticing, and Minecraft in particular, unlike other video games, Minecraft is the game that never ends. There's no finite definitive period in which the game finishes. There are no levels, prescriptive levels to reach, unlike there are in other video games. So this is literally like reading a book with an infinite number of chapters in it. You just keep going and going. And the reason I think that a lot of children, people are often asking why they're so obsessed or so interested in Minecraft. And I think it actually ties back to historically when kids started to get around that age range of sort of 6 to 10, 12 years, they often used to have backyards or parks or local neighbourhoods to literally go and roam and explore and play with. And we're often not seeing that these days because of, you know, a whole raft of social factors. A lot of parents are working increased hours. There are safety concerns about children having that sort of open play sort of space. So what children are doing is gravitating to a digital world like Minecraft, where they can roam unsupervised and they can play and explore and test out things. So I think it's sort of a natural tendency for what children have always developmentally needed, but they're often trying to seek that out now in a digital platform as well. So I think that's part of the appeal for Minecraft. There's another neuroscientific explanation, and that is with Minecraft, with any technology, including video games, when children solve a problem or they reach the next level in a video game or they are rewarded some way, they're told, good job, well done, you've solved the problem, what we know is that their brain actually releases some of the neurotransmitter dopamine, which is the feel-good hormone. And so all of a sudden, like anything in life, even as adults, you know, this is why a lot of us are attached, shall I say, to Facebook and other forms of social media, our brains are literally getting little squirts of dopamine at the same time. So our children are using video games and using Minecraft and getting those little squirts of dopamine. So what do they want? More and more of those squirts of dopamine. And that's why we get our otherwise well-adjusted, you know, 6- and 9-year-old children having the techno tantrum, which is exactly like a toddler tantrum because they're asked to turn off the video game or switch off Minecraft. So it's literally that dopamine craving that they're after.
Great description. So I haven't heard that analogy before. So then are we setting them up for a fall because when they go back into real life, they're not getting those constant bits of dopamine pumped into them? So how does that work?
Often. And so we are seeing, almost a generation of children who are becoming really contingent upon praise and reward and levels that they often get in video games and in worlds like Minecraft. So that can potentially set up that I've heard, I'm trying to think of his name. He's a brilliant neuroscientist. He's written A Smart Baby, John Medina. And John Medina talks about, Dr. John Medina, how we are literally over-praising and rewarding children, so much so that they're addicted to praise and reward. And I think we're seeing that in the digital world too.
And the instant gratification, I imagine, as well.
Absolutely. And that's a really big thing. When I talk to teachers, they overwhelmingly say today's kids expect and want instant gratification, which can be a good thing if you're trying to teach them maths concepts or, you know, really abstract science concepts. You can teach them that, you know, 6 8s aren't 48 or 49, that they're 48. So that instant feedback and that instant gratification can be positive. But having said all that, I've pointed out all the negative features of video games. They can be actually really beneficial if you find the right sorts of games for your children. In fact, there's a really huge push, particularly in the US at the moment, with their education system and researchers actually looking for how they can leverage games-based learning to support children's learning in classrooms. Because they can see, I mean, any parent often can see their children can become mesmerized in a video game and literally spend hours on a task. And teachers are trying to replicate that same focus and attention in the classroom. You know, wouldn't it be great if we had our 8-year-old boys engrossed in learning, you know, the attributes of 3D shapes, which they can do. So video games, when you choose, and obviously content is really critical, aggressive antisocial games can be really detrimental, especially to boys. They seem to be more susceptible to the adverse effects of video games. But if we're choosing age-appropriate games, then children can benefit from them. Again, it comes back to finding the right content.
Okay. And have you got any examples for the kind of 6 to 8?
Look, Minecraft is actually one that I would recommend. Oh, however,
I've been hearing that from you.
They do. I'm not endorsed or paid by children to say that. It really is a good one, but before you ever get your child, or if you're already using it, you really need to come up, I call it a Minecraft management plan. So say you have very firm parameters on when it's going to be used and how it's going to be used and how long it's going to be used. And a simple thing with Minecraft is often giving children a time limit isn't necessarily the easiest way, especially to manage Minecraft, because your child might be in the middle of crafting something or making something. Often, and if you just say, okay, 15 minutes is up, you know, turn it off, it can, yeah, and for the reason is that they, when they're playing Minecraft or another video game, they often enter what we call the psychological state of flow, and they're literally so immersed in what they're doing, they're almost oblivious to everything else going on around them. And as adults, we have that, you know, the days at work when we're really super productive and, you know, before you know it, it's 12 o'clock and 3 hours have just slipped by at work. So we enter that psychological state, and that's exactly what happens when children play video games. So if all of a sudden we go in and interrupt that state of flow, it's really an abrupt ending. So often with Minecraft, I say to parents two ways to manage it without the techno tantrum. One is to get your child to, before they go on, to tell you exactly what they plan to do while they're in there. So what are they planning on crafting, or is there a particular aspect that they're going to explore? So they've got some firm parameters over exactly what they're doing. And the other good transition point away from Minecraft is when it transitions from day to night. That's often a really good way to get the kids to say, okay, that's enough. Because as I said before, it literally is the game with an infinite number of chapters that just don't ever end.
Brilliant. So I must confess that we don't actually have Minecraft because I won't let my son on it.
And do you know what? You're probably saving yourself a lot of heartache. I hear more and more parents saying that they've ended up taking it off their children because their children just couldn't cope with it. So
yeah, it's good fun.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's great. Thank you. You're so knowledgeable and honest. I'm glad I'm talking to you, and so will my audience be. It's exciting. The fourth myth I've got here is screen time causes ADD and ADHD.
Yes, another really common myth. And one that a lot of parents are really concerned about. This is actually not grounded in any science. What we do know is that there is definitely a correlation. So children that have some attentional issues, whether they be ADD or ADHD, do tend to spend more time with screens. But what we don't have is causation research. So we don't have anything that proves that screens cause that. Is it the chicken or is it the egg? Are children with attentional issues more likely to gravitate towards the rapid-fire, fast-paced screens because that's what their brains are craving? Or is it that screen use that's causing those attentional issues? And at this point in time, we don't have any evidence to say that it's causing ADD or ADHD. So that's a really common myth that actually isn't true. A bit like what we were told when we were growing up, you know, that TV would give you square eyes. Mm-hmm. Definitely not true. So happy to dispel that one. Oh, having said that, though, technology is definitely changing our attention spans. Sure. But that's obviously
a different issue. I mean, that comes into, you know, ADHD and ADD. Is it diet related? Is it exercise? You know, there's a whole range of causes or potential causes in there. And so you're right, it can't just be screen time.
Absolutely. I think it's a really multifaceted, you know, issue to look at, not just a single aspect, as you said.
Okay, and the fifth myth, our last myth, is kids are easily addicted to technology. Can't wait for this one.
And this is one I'm often asked by the media. They often like to say, are our kids, you know, addicted to technology? And what we actually know from the psychological research that only a very small proportion of children are actually formally and medically addicted to technology. We estimate somewhere between 1% and 3% of children are legitimately addicted. If we want a medical formal diagnosis, instead we've got children, I like to say, that have perhaps formed some unhealthy media habits, whether that's through the types of activities they're engaging in, whether parents have sort of been a bit lax and let screen time. Screen time can be, I often say to parents, a very slippery slope. You know, once you get on, then they want more and more of it. So children are definitely, sometimes I might say, obsessed or attached to technology, but they're not necessarily addicted. It's more, I believe, especially up until around the age of 8 years, children, I don't believe, are addicted. They've just formed some unhealthy relationships with technology. Mm-hmm. So there's help, there's hope, and there's help.
That all comes back around to doing, you know, being consistent and monitoring behaviours and guidelines, as you said earlier, isn't it?
It is. It really is all about balance. And just, you know, I hear a lot of parents asking me, when do they need to start talking to their children about screen time and technology? And I actually say it's the minute you hand your smartphone over to your two-year-old or to your toddler. You really need to start to implement limits because it's much easier to do it from the beginning or where you are now rather than further down the track when it's obviously a lot harder to try to implement or to regiment then.
And this is one from left field. So what are they, like Nanny Net, or what are the best filters that we can put on our technology to keep out the...
Look, this is a really common question, and I actually say there's no software, there's no filter, it's your eyeballs and your presence. And this is not because I'm in no way affiliated with any particular brand. There are certainly things, you know, filters that you can set up on your devices, on all platforms. There are commercial programs that you can buy, but nothing is, you know, a better filter than you being present or in close proximity. Really big thing here, I often talk to parents about what I call no-go tech zones, and what are the places in your house where technology just doesn't go. Bedrooms really, in an ideal world, shouldn't be technology places. However, I know that's not always the case. You know, it's very easy for smartphones to be snuck into pajama pockets and pulled out into beds. So there are definitely lots and lots of filters out there, and it's really hard to specify one because, you know, there's Mac software that works really well on a Mac and PC, and then you've got all your iOS devices. You definitely, I think, for children that are going to be using it, perhaps without you being, you know, as vigilant all the time, you definitely need some filters there. But really just having open conversations with your child and supervising, unfortunately, the chances are they are going to come into contact, whether it be unsavory websites or lyrics to songs. And part of our job is to help them, guide them through this. And I think sometimes if we have too strong a filter, we miss those teachable moments. We want children to have open conversations and dialogue with us too. At the same time, we don't want our children accessing pornographic material or, you know, things that they don't need to be seeing. So definitely use your settings and your filters to limit what they can access, but also take a really active role and talk them through and observe what they're doing as well.
Brilliant, thank you. Thanks for sharing your absolute invaluable knowledge and breaking down the technology myths. I'm sure it will alleviate much stress and guilt over screen time, our conversations. Yeah. And now, where can we find you?
At the moment, I'm at everychancetolearn.com.au. And I speak to parents throughout Australia and to teachers as well, all about how technology is shaping all aspects of childhood, including the way they think, learn, and develop.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks very much.
Pleasure. My pleasure.
Stop it. Thank you.